Tell me, old worm, is there a monster podcast hidden in that monster body of yours? What a shock for the gentle patrons.
I sent you that episode long ago.
Ha! Nobody listens to your goddamn podcast.
You often listened.
Say what?
Even when you didn't know it.
Say again?
Texan Melky.
I mean, I imagine him like as a total cowboy. But, oh my gosh.
He rolled pretty deep with Gas Helen and Malky.
Welcome to Gom Jabbar, your guide to the iconic world of Dune. We'll be exploring the themes, philosophies, and characters found in the sandy depths of this vast universe, from Frank Herbert's groundbreaking novels to the adaptations on film and TV. My name's Abu.
My name is Leo.
And Leo?
Yeah.
We are back, cowboy.
I reckon we are.
God Emperor of goddamn Dune.
I reckon we got a couple more pages we're covering in today's episode. Not to get ahead of ourselves, but that's
not to get too damn
the general vibe of that's the vibe of the podcast, I darn reckon.
You darn reckon right, darn tootin', shootin', fruitin', tootin', lootin'. Okay, enough of that. Welcome back to another episode of our God Emperor of Dune deep dive, folks. We are
welcome to 2024.
And also welcome to 2024 and our new accents we're trying out this year.
Yeah.
We are nearing the end of this book. My God, the end is in sight.
It is.
Only a few chapters left to go, and they are spectacular. Cannot wait to get into today's reading.
Yeah, classic Frank Herbert. Steady, gentle meander throughout hundreds and hundreds of pages into a breakneck conclusion. So very exciting. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's cover our housekeeping, starting with spoiler warning. Hey, it's a book club. Can you believe it? No spoilers beyond the pages and books we've covered thus far. So if you're caught up, you're safe. Nothing you don't know.
That's right. And of course, at the top of the show, a huge shout out to our Kwisatz Haderach level patron, Case Aiken.
Ugh.
Case, you have been with us for so long as a Kwisatz Haderach level patron. We are so grateful for your support.
It's true.
And sir, the clone of you that we have made is identical. There's nothing about you we need to change. No training. Okay? We don't need a clone that's the opposite of you.
Right, right.
We need more of you in this world, and we've done it.
Yeah, it was a weird, we were like, can you take a few cells of this person's body and grow us a new one?
Uh-huh.
And they were like, do you want to change them in some way? And it's like, no.
No.
It's exactly the same. They're like, that's just a normal clone, I think. We're like, no, it's important
that
you get exactly right, because Case is really a spectacular person.
Yeah. It did fail, though, because science has not caught up with replicating that much generosity. So the results were inconclusive. We'll get back to you on that. Case, thank you so much for your support. Of course, a huge shout out to all of our patrons, to all of our listeners who help genuinely make this show possible week to week. We appreciate you, we see you, and we're grateful.
Indeed we are. All right, today's episode. Y'all know the game plan. We are going to begin with a summary of today's chapters, the assigned reading, and then we're going to dive into a couple of takeaways, a couple of good ones, and then we'll wrap up with some yummy spice morsels.
Yum.
Today's spice morsels are from a bento box, because they're basically all about Japanese traditional stuff.
That's
so very cool. Very exciting. But before we get to our chapter summaries, we are going to take a quick break. So don't go anywhere. When we're back, we're talking about chapter 45.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back, everyone. Let's dive right into our chapter summaries for today's reading, starting with chapter 45. Today's first chapter takes place in the Little Citadel 6 days after Siona and Duncan arrived at Tuono Village.
Right.
And as has been the case for many chapters now, Leto is moody and he is anxious, he is emotional, and he is taking it out on Moneo.
Yeah.
He's like really stressed about this 6 day delay, even though it is, to be fair, his fault.
Literally
Leto's fault
that
this wedding is delayed and that all the plans have to be changed. But poor Moneo is still receiving the brunt of all of the anxiety and emotion.
Really is the worst fucking boss in the world. He's like, hey, can you quickly change absolutely everything? And then a few days later is like, I don't like how long you're taking to change everything on a dime. How dare you?
Exactly.
Moneo's like, I haven't slept in 3 months. All right.
Yeah. I do not ever want Moneo's job.
No.
I don't care how much he gets paid and what that 401k matches. It's not worth it. Now, when Moneo asks Leto why they're just here in the Citadel waiting around, like, what the fuck are we doing? Don't we have a wedding to plan? Right. Leto reveals that Malky is about to arrive in just a couple of minutes. So not only is everything Moneo's fault and Leto is annoyed, but Leto's also keeping secrets from Moneo.
Yeah.
On top of that, Leto also has a job for Moneo.
Yeah.
He says, hey, buddy, we've been together a long time. I might need a little favor from you.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What is
Quote,
it?
Quote, perhaps we will have to dispose of Malky. He is a problem. End quote.
Moneo, did you also bring a fucking shovel? No reason.
Now, in this conversation, Leto also reveals that Antioch died on that secret mission to Ix.
That sucks. That's sad.
Although it wasn't a wasteful death, because she did manage to delay the Spacing Guild and the Tleilaxu, who also were converging on Ix. She delayed them long enough for the fish speakers to infiltrate and to grab Malky, and thus Malky is coming here.
Yeah, I also really appreciated, because I think at one point Moneo says something kind of disparaging of Antioch, and Leto's like, nah, she was great.
She was a real one.
Put some respect on her name. And I like that. It's like, as confrontational and as antagonistic as Leto is with a lot of the powers that be in the universe, he still is that, like, Atreidian. He respects people who have quality, and like, they plant their flags and they dig their heels in. He's like, I respect that. And she was a good one. She was great.
Totally. He goes so far as to say, I wish she hadn't died in this way.
Yeah.
She deserved better, but this is how it had to be.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of where they grabbed Malky, he was in a hiding place. Mm-hmm. And we find out in this chapter that this hiding place was a no room, which is the much rumored Ixian machine we've been talking so much about in this whole book. And what's special about this no room is that it's able to block even Leto to Atreides' prescient abilities. Everything inside is blind to anyone looking into the future. And after this mission on Ix, Leto says that cat's out of the bag now. Everyone in the galaxy will soon find out about this no room, and the technology will soon spread. Now, Malky, our boy, finally arrives, and this is such a juicy and hilarious conversation. I had a goofy grin on my face the entire time. He certainly earns his title of rogue. To me, he was giving off these like major Han Solo vibes throughout the whole conversation, you know, snarky and witty, and he's doesn't give a shit about what anyone thinks. He is shit talking the God Emperor, calling him the old worm right in front of Moneo, you know, like Moneo is clutching his pearls, shocked at how Malky is speaking. Now, we will dive a little deeper into the Malky and Leto conversation later in the takeaways, so hang tight for that. We will circle back to this conversation. For now, what I do want to say is it's interesting to note that Moneo is an outsider in this group chat.
Yes.
I found this quote interesting. Quote, He felt excluded from this conversation, an object of amusement by two superior beings. Malky and the God Emperor were almost like two old friends reliving the pleasures of a mutual past. End quote.
Yeah, really third wheeling it.
Third wheeling it, definitely. And it's a tough look for Moneo. I mean, we've all been there, so, you know, I hope he's not sweating it too much. But yeah. It's an awkward position for him to be in. And to see the disrespect with which Malky is speaking, but also the sort of like camaraderie bromance these two have going on that Moneo has never been able to have with his lord. Now, at the end of this Malky and Leto conversation, Leto indirectly commands Moneo to kill Malky for him, basically. He's just like, oh, Moneo, can you like do the thing we talked about earlier before? And Moneo gets the message and he's like, okay, I'll kill him. And Malky panics, of course. You know, Malky's like, you're the best, Leto. You're the most evil this universe has ever seen. Congrats, you motherfucker. You know, like Malky's screaming at the top of his lungs. And Leto has to walk to the other side of the chamber because he just can't witness this moment happen as Moneo carries out his task and ends Malky's life.
This is such a mafioso moment. Mm-hmm. Like, Lord, if you wait at the end of the corridor... I think that maybe your little problem isn't going to be a problem anymore, if you catch my meaning. Leto's like, I'm going to wriggle over here.
yep. That's exactly how it played out.
Yeah, perhaps when you return, it'll no longer be a problem. It's so funny.
Now, I do want to point out, while Moneo is carrying out this execution, Leto walks over to the edge of the chamber, looks out across the Sarir, and... has this like really dark moment. This quote really caught me off guard. Quote, what a long drop that would be out there. Just roll off the landing lip. He doubted that even his body would survive it. But there was no water in the sand beneath his tower, and he could feel the golden path winking in and out of existence merely because he allowed himself to think of such an end. End quote.
Yeah, that's... that's dark and that's heavy. It is a reminder that I think I often think of Leto as only having prescience and only using prescience the way that we've seen it in previous books. But it does literally seem like he's got sort of a barometer of like, is the golden path, is not the golden path on track? Mm-hmm. And the idea that he can literally feel it blinking in and out of existence just because he's contemplating ending his life this way.
Oof.
It's so fascinating. So interesting. Right.
So interesting. That if he were to perish in this moment right here, everything he's worked for 3,000 plus years would come to an end.
Yeah.
It's not the correct path. And like you said, it's dark, it's shocking, it's sad. I think it also reveals two really interesting points that we have touched on before in the past. Firstly, it shows us that Leto genuinely cared about Malky. As you stated earlier, he does seem to have genuine connections, even for the people he has to send to their deaths, like Antioch. But it also reveals just how truly trapped he is. The God Emperor, any decision he makes about who lives, who dies, must adhere to the Golden Path, whether that decision is about someone else or even himself. And that, I think, shows us just the kind of sort of anguish and torturous life that Leto has lived for thousands of years now. He has to commit to this thing, otherwise it's game over for all of humanity. And so he has no choice. If he has to send a loved one to their death, he has to. Otherwise, he will see the golden path winking in and out of existence.
Yeah.
It's wild to think about. I think it's one of the clearest looks at Leto's existence and how he maintains the golden path. Real interesting. Now, of course, the chapter ends as Moneo silences Malky once and for all. And I do want us all to just sort of take a moment here, because we have witnessed the end of an icon, and I like to think the end of the line of Bronzo of Ix.
Yeah.
Right? He has to be descendant from Bronzo of Ix. That's, of course, just my headcanon. There's no actual canon verifies this, but that amount of sass and roguish charm it's got to be passed down in the family line.
Questioning an Atreides. Like, you're like, yeah. As our great-grandfather once instructed us, you must always be a sassy little man questioning the Atreides at all times. And they go, this is my grandfather's critiques of the Atreides passed down over the generations.
Totally, yeah. And look, they're both Ixians, you know? Like,
that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
It's a possibility. Show me the genealogical charts.
That's a real possibility. That's really funny. At first, I was just like, yeah, attitude-wise, but you're right. Both Ixians, both. Yeah. That's funny. I will throw in here very quickly. Throughout this book, I've always had the sort of like suspicion that Moneo is bisexual or gay.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only so many bits of evidence that I've ever been able to like pull together as I look. But this chapter actually provides a couple that continue to kind of like push me in the direction of thinking, at the very least, bisexual, that actually Moneo and Malky had something, or maybe Malky kind of teased Moneo, but that Malky was an object of desire for Moneo.
Interesting. Yeah.
And even in looking it up, like online to see if I'm crazy with this, like, out there theory that's completely unfounded because I want LGBTQ characters in every book that I read.
Yeah.
There are other people who've brought this up and have mentioned the same things, but there's this line in this reading, in this chapter, where Leto is talking to Moneo about Malky, and he says to Moneo, I know that Malky offered you greater temptations than any other. And Moneo says, Lord, I never... And Leto says, I know that, Moneo. But surprise has shocked your memories alive, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And it starts to kind of make sense with the way that Malky seems to be such a sore subject for Moneo. Like, he is kind of like this jilted, he was played by this con man and this rogue who could like maybe hook up with him and then be like, oh, I never cared about you or whatever. Like, that's something that this fucking guy would do.
Totally.
And even later, Malky says to Moneo, hey there, old friend Moneo. And Moneo snaps, I was never your friend. And Malky says, companion among the Horus, then.
Yeah.
Which, again, it just feels like there's more to the surface. Again, I don't think that there's a definitive way of knowing, for sure, one way or the other.
Right.
But God, if we could know that, think about the way that that would change so many of the conversations that he has with Duncan. Think about the way that that would change so much of the undertones of some of their scenes.
Totally.
It's such an interesting possibility. And I know that there's not enough evidence to fully lock it in as something that like we can prove Frank intended. But if you out there in listener land ever had that thought, yo, me too.
Yeah.
It's also totally possible that perhaps when Moneo was younger and more of the rebel and less of the bureaucrat, Malky tempted him with thoughts of freedom from the worm and thoughts of escape like that.
Right, right.
There's so many possibilities.
Totally. But yeah, yeah.
It's one of those things that has been bothering me for a bit. And then this chapter, I remember, this is part of why I really thought that. So anyway, just wanted to put that out there.
Totally. At the very least, there seems to be some history, whether romantic or otherwise. There's some beef here between these two.
Sure. Yeah.
For sure. You know, the way they're speaking to each other and how riled up Moneo gets whenever Malky's mentioned.
Yeah.
Even the fact that Leto keeps it secret until minutes before Malky's arrival. There's got to be more there, definitely.
And that carries us into chapter 46.
Mm-hmm.
So chapter 46 of our reading is a pretty short one. It's pretty brief. We're with bored out of his mind Duncan Idaho and petulant water waster Siona Atreides.
Ugh, right.
The worst. And they are, of course, in Tuona Village.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Siona has been killing time by reading and rereading Leto's journals. And then, of course, just taking the longest, weirdest baths.
Longest. Most wasteful.
Just the longest. It's a front to Arrakis as a planet. And that's how bad the baths are.
Yeah.
It's so long.
There's not even any hot water left for Duncan after.
Yeah. He's having to take lukewarm baths, Siona, you monster. And Duncan is not loving the village. He's not like, oh yeah, this has really come around since I started giving what's-his-name Fremen lessons. No, he still kind of hates it. And he's spending a lot of his time just trying to like chill, kill time. He's trying not to think about Hui, the object of his ultimate desires, marrying that giant fucking worm. You know, he's doing his best.
Right.
Which is to say, not very well. But
not very well. He seems to be thinking about it a lot.
He's thinking about not thinking about it just enough to, you know, it's bad. It's not great.
Yeah, certainly.
But suddenly, the monotony is broken when one of Garun's aides, Teshar, rushes into their room to share the most exciting news this town has ever fucking got, ever.
For real.
Like, hands down. The God Emperor has changed his plans. He is now going to be having his wedding there in Tuono.
Oh my goodness.
My lord. This is very along the lines of, like, you're in Amarillo, Texas, and you find out that, like, the Super Bowl is happening there. It's like,
yeah.
I got to think that Garun is like, I don't have the infrastructure for this kind of wedding. Are you fucking kidding me? Like, this is a bureaucratic nightmare.
I can't support this.
This is what awful. This is going to bankrupt our little city.
Not enough parking.
There's not enough parking at all.
That's a great point.
Millions, millions of attendees. We have four shacks and they're all falling apart. This sucks. Yeah. Leto's like, it's a destination wedding and the destination's a pile of shit.
Yep. I do love that Teshar, right after he delivers this news, he rushes to the next house over. He's like Paul revering this news because it's so exciting, you know?
The Emperor is coming! The Emperor is coming! Okay. Yeah. He rushes off. Siona and Duncan are alone again, and Siona actually breaks the silence. She talks a bit. And she actually reads a passage from the journals to Duncan and tells him about how her friends sacrificed themselves to steal the journals, basically.
Yeah. Recall Kwuteg.
Kwuteg. Put his fucking goat Kwuteg. Greatest goddamn character in this book. Hit a wolf with a wolf. My favorite. And she's so like, anime. And she's like, yo, my 10 friends died getting these books. And Duncan responds with the funniest quote. Well, you're a lousy commander.
Shit.
And quote, spectacular. This made me laugh. Ass. It's so funny because she's like, fuck off. No, I'm not. Fuck you. He's an awful, evil. What do you mean?
Right.
She's like,
wait a second.
Combative, but also like, how? What do you mean? And he explains, like, you're inexperienced. You made obvious mistakes. It's like you knew there were wolves and later you poisoned them, which was great. But you didn't think of that before you ran in there with your 10 friends.
Right.
Whose fucking fault is that? You didn't plan well enough and you were in charge. Yeah, you're shit. You're a bad commander.
Damn.
You just needlessly wasted the lives of your companions, which has got to really sting for someone like Siona, who I keep reading her as kind of petulant and detached. But remember, every time her companions come up, her eyes get misty. Like she almost cries just thinking about her friends. This is still a very open wound for her. So for him to be like, for real, that was entirely you. Like, you knew the stakes and you went into it half-cocked with a bad plan. Sounds like your fault.
Totally.
But it is cool to see Duncan's military mind at work. Like, this is what makes Duncan a great leader when it comes to, like, military organizations. And I imagine this is similar to, like, Gurney Halleck and the military leadership, the sort of, like, personnel-minded leadership of don't waste people is a very House Atreides thing. If this was House Harkonnen, you can imagine they'd go, well, you got the journals? Cool. Doesn't matter how many people died, you accomplished your goal. Those who died were probably weak anyway. Let's go. Right. But it's a very Atreidian thing to be like, you got the journals. Great. But you wasted a lot of lives unnecessarily. Right. Very cool.
Yeah, great point.
Well, the chapter wraps up as the two basically start cooking up a plot. They're like, knowing he's coming here, what can we do? And Duncan's like, well, Nayla's got the laser gun. And Siona's like, she's not going to use the laser gun against the God Emperor. And Duncan's like, then kill her and take the laser gun. What are you hooked up on? Like, isn't this super obvious? And she's like, it does seem like someone who's not yet committed to the idea of killing, talking to someone who's very used to it. And he's just like, well, if she doesn't give you the tool, kill her and take it.
Right.
So they've got a three-step plan. Step one, they got to convince Nayla to use the laser gun. Order her to and figure out a way to make sure she does, or kill her and take it and use it themselves. Step two, they have to figure out how the God Emperor will arrive so they can like set up an ambush or do something. They're like, we need to figure out how he's getting here. Step three, kind of some question marks, and then step four is profit. So it's profit. A four-step plan. Some ambiguity in there, yeah. But by the end, profit, and perhaps they'll be rid of the wormy boy.
Right, right. Find a penny stock, invest in it, and we win by the end.
Profit. She goes back and forth. The stolen journals and like a guide for day trading. She's like really getting into the crypto, you know, blockchain space. And she's just as obnoxious as most of those people. So yeah. It's perfect.
It's perfect. It's perfect.
And those are our chapters that we've assigned. Mm-hmm. So we are going to get into our takeaways. We're going to talk about Malky and Twi. We're going to talk about Latos. Beautiful, beautiful words. Tricky, tricky bastard. But first, we're going to take a quick break. So don't go anywhere. When we're back, we've got our takeaways.
Welcome back, everyone. Now that we're done with our chapter summaries, y'all know what's next. Let's get into these takeaways, and specifically, let's talk about this conversation between Malky and Leto. In particular, we want to focus on what we learn about Hui and what the implications are of some of Malky's revelations here, some of the info that Leto gets out of him. And of course, we have to start with Malky's iconic response.
Yeah.
When Leto says that, yes, in fact, the rumors are true, and I will be wedding Hui Nori.
Right.
Malky responds with, quote, tell me, old worm.
Oh, this voice again. Great.
Is there a monster penis hidden in that monster body of yours?
Yeah.
What a shock for the gentle Hui.
Okay.
End quote.
He's kind of migrated from Texas toward maybe Louisiana, Mississippi, but I appreciate this. This is great.
And of course, we know that Malky is straight up just goading Leto with this comment, right? This is a full-on troll. He is well aware that Leto no longer has any sort of genitalia. They've had this discussion before at some point in the past, and this is just nothing more than a jab. Yeah. And in fact, a jab that we know perhaps does hurt Leto quite a bit, because Leto's over here like, oh, Hui is so beautiful. I'm so horny. God. But he can't act on it. It can't be a physical affection between the two. Now, from this exchange, we do get some really interesting insight into why perhaps Leto respects Malky so much, despite Malky's like very clear disdain for the God Emperor and very clear disrespect. Quote, you often told me the truth, Leto said, even when you didn't know it. End quote.
Right. Yeah.
That is so interesting when you take into account what we have learned about Leto and Moneo and Nayla throughout this book. Uh-huh. Right? Leto is surrounded by people that constantly yes lord him all the time.
Right, totally.
And clearly, Malky was someone that challenged Leto, perhaps even to his face, like he is doing so here. And very few people in Leto's life, or at least in the last couple thousand years, have likely done that, right? Who would dare challenge a god to the god's face? Malky had the audacity to do that. And Malky, as we know from the Dune Encyclopedia, we did a little morsel about him a while back, we know he's extremely intelligent as well.
Yeah.
And so Malky not only had the gumption to kind of be a dick to Leto's face, but he also had the intelligence to challenge him intellectually. And I'm sure Leto found that refreshing after thousands and thousands of drones that said nothing but, yes, Lord, as you wish, Lord.
Yeah, 100%. I also see within that quote, even when you didn't know it, makes me feel like it was the way that Malky behaved and even what he did unintentionally and without intending to, though his comments, his sarcasm, all of that was a better way of communicating the truth than like many people can even get to, right?
Yes.
And we know that some quality of Malky is necessary for Hui to exist. And Hui is one of those people who just is so present in the moment with you that regardless of what she's saying, you trust her and you know that she is trustworthy. I imagine there's a similar quality of Malky where even when he's being a sarcastic, combative asshole, going, I do declare, Mr. Worm, you big wormy boy, in his classic Missouri drawl. I imagine even in those moments, Leto got a lot out of those interactions and learned more about the truth from him than he does other people who are just saying, yes, Lord, to your point.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting acknowledgement of Malky's value to Leto and
certainly
maybe what was the bedrock of their camaraderie, as fraught as it was.
Right, right.
Now, after some prodding, not a ton, but after some, Malky does reveal that the Tlaylax who helped the Ixians in making Hui Nari's creation, but they only provided knowledge. They weren't like hands-on. It was just, we need to know how to do this. We need to know your techniques, things like right. that. And they helped.
Right.
Now, naturally, Moneo is like, ew, oh God, oh, ew,
Tlaylax,
oh
Tlaylax.
No, ew, oh, no, oh, okay, I need a glass of water or something. But then Leto's like, shut up.
Right. Oh, we're talking.
Stop it, third wheel.
Yeah.
Third wheel Moneo, that's what I'm going to call you from now on. But it effectively confirms what Leto suspected, which was that mm-hmm. Hui was made of Malky and not tampered with or fucked with by the Tlaylaxu.
Like, right.
Yes, the Tlaylaxu are dirty. Yes, we're disgusted by everything they do, but she is a product of purely the Ixians with right. some help from the outside.
And I do find that a little interesting that he's confirming that. I suspect Leto also doesn't really like the Tlaylaxu.
No.
And he's maybe kind of like, we're good. Like, no Tlaylaxu shenanigans have been done with Hui. We're good with my bride-to-be. And Malky's like, yeah. Like, it's purely Ixian. I do find it a little funny that Leto also is like double-checking that there's no Tlaylaxu nonsense in here.
No.
Probably because he doesn't want to be caught off guard, right? The Tlaylaxu, with their many Duncan Golas, have tried many tricks against him over the years.
Right.
But also, I like to think, because he also thinks the Tlaylaxu are fucking awful.
Yeah. Sort of like, whew, that's good. And Moneo's right. like, excuse me. You are marrying her, though. Like, you were already...
Right. What have I been planning for 3 months?
Yeah. Was there doubts? There were doubts this whole time. Fuck me. This is the worst. This is the worst boss I've ever had. And the only boss, yes, but still. Ugh. God. Terrible.
Totally. Now, in addition to confirming that there was no Tlaylaxu tampering with Hui, Malky also confirms another detail that Leto has long suspected about Hui's upbringing and perhaps her origins. Malky says, quote, just a few tiny cells from my body. Then the carefully nurtured growth and education. Everything in exact opposite to your old friend Malky. End quote. So that confirms it for us. Hui is some sort of clone and or Gola recreation of Malky himself, but she has been genetically tweaked and has been educated to be his opposite in almost every way, physically and in temperament. This revelation leads to a hilarious exchange where Moneo panics once again, and this time he offers to call off the wedding, like, we could just call it all quits right now, Leto, just say the word.
Yeah.
And Leto responds, quote, the exact opposite of Malky. Didn't you hear him? End quote. And Malky follows up with, quote, what could be better? End quote.
Sorry, I think you mean, well, what could be better?
What could be better?
Back to Texas. Okay. What could be better? Anyway, what a great response.
What a response. Funny. Yeah. I mean, again, Malky is just so sarcastic and such a dick in this whole conversation. And lest we forget, he's like bleeding out right now, you know, like he's been injured during the assault by the fish speakers and he's literally in pain. And he's still got the energy in him to troll the shit out of Leto.
One other notable detail here is that Malky reveals the existence of the No Room, this top secret Ixian machine that hides anything inside from basically prescient or prescient beings.
Right.
And it's interesting because, one, Leto says, quote, they have improved upon a device they gave me long ago.
Right.
End quote. And we know that Dar Es Balat, like the collection of all of his journals and stuff, was found in basically like a No Room prototype. basically might even be one of the first no rooms in all of history.
Right.
So it's interesting for him to kind of confirm where his journals are and going to be. Like, I don't know if he's been as explicit about like, oh yeah, and I'm keeping all of them in effectively a no room. It kind of feels like we're just now learning that no rooms exist. And yet he's like, oh, and they gave me one a while ago. It's like fucking.
Right. He has like an early prototype.
Yeah. He's got the no room 1.0. They're up there like no room 7. It's right, got three cameras and touch ID. Yeah. It's this advancement of technology, which initially you might be like, well, what plots are they going to use this technology in? Like, doesn't this destabilize his security? Doesn't this jeopardize his empire? No, he's like, this is part of the path. Like, we kind of need this. And remember that, like, the whole reason Siona is a big deal is that she doesn't show up in Prescient Vision. And he needs her as who she is to pass that gene on to as many people as possible. And that's how, down the line, that the smell of machine oil and the hunting, seeking, prescient hunter that is going to hunt down all of humanity at some point, that thing is avoided if enough humans have this anti-prescient gene marker that Siona has. But also, golly, sure would be nice for people who don't have the gene marker not to be just immediately automatically fucked. So good to have stuff like the no room where you could have a community living and not have to worry about being sussed out by prescient beings.
Yeah. It all seems in line with the larger plan of the Golden Path, right? Leto's goal is to make prescient a moot point in human culture, in human society, in human history.
Yeah.
And in order to do that, he's been working toward creating someone like Siona. But alongside that, I think he's also allowed the Ixians to create the No Room. Because remember, he's powerful enough to fucking crush them and wipe them off the map any minute.
Right.
But he doesn't. And if he doesn't, perhaps there's a reason. And now we know the reason.
Indeed we do.
So that's our first takeaway for today. This conversation with Malky and the revelations about Hui and the No Room.
Yeah.
Some big stuff. Some things we already suspected, that Leto already suspected, but have now been confirmed for us from the mouth of Malky himself.
Yeah.
For our second takeaway, we want to stay within this conversation because it's so dense and there's so much here. During this exchange, Leto brings up an interesting mistake from his past. And it's worth taking a minute to explore this more deeply because there's some interesting information here. So Leto says to Moneo, quote, "You know, Moneo, once, tens of thousands of years ago, when I was another person, I made a mistake. My mistake was compounded by the beautiful way in which I expressed it." End quote.
Okay. Brag about it. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Brag about it, my guy. Okay.
I said something stupid, but I said it so beautifully.
Oh, so eloquent. So Micah, you had to be there.
Fucking eloquent. Oh my God. People were saying, did you hear what he said? And then they would quote me word for word. Oh,
yeah. Beautiful. It was just too beautiful. So beautiful.
So beautiful.
And Malky, of course, has a very on-brand response to this. He says, quote, "Tricks with words." Malky taunted, end quote. So he's out here still jabbing at Leto.
Yeah.
And this is very much in line with a theme we've talked about in this book quite a few times now, right? This idea of the power of words, how much power language does and can have in human society, but also how much it lacks in capturing true human experience. That's been a huge theme in this book, and we've talked about it a couple of times on the podcast. And that's, again, sort of what Leto is getting at here. Tens of thousands of years ago, there was a mistake said, but it was said so beautifully that people believed it.
It also very much shows how well Malky understands Leto and understands some of Leto's lessons that even characters that we're seeing today struggle to understand. Leto is like, words don't mean fucking anything. Like, words are totally useless. And characters we're seeing in this book are going, what do you mean? And Malky is out here having very well learned that lesson. He's like, oh, yeah, he loves words.
He
loves pretty words. He loves
him and his words.
What does he say? Yeah, you see how tricky he is with words? He knows all the tricks of language that have ever been discovered. And he's clearly treating it all with that sort of cynical eye of the trickster, of the liar. he says, oh, look at how powerful he is with this thing. So he uses the power to be manipulative and whatever, mm-hmm. where I think Leto would argue he's like, no, like, words don't mean anything. Like, I'm not, that's not like my sales pitch that controls people.
I'm just
frustrated by the fact that language doesn't have any implicit meaning.
Right.
But it is interesting to see, even in that little jab, tricks with words, he taunted, shows that Malky has spent a lot of time with Leto and has learned very well the sort of shape and maybe path of Leto's kind of meandering TED Talks. He's like, oh yeah, I've heard that one before. The tricky word talk. Ugh. Love it.
Yeah. It's easy to imagine that Malky would see right through Sihanouk, you know? Malky wouldn't be like, all that in one word,
all
Lord.
That in a word, Lord.
Malky would be like, you tricky motherfucker. You're lying.
Yeah.
To all of these women who think you're a god, you know? He would see right through that.
He's like, you fucking con man. Leto's like, don't tell anyone.
Don't tell anyone. Or I'll kill you.
Or I'll kill you. I will thwump you with my body.
So Leto continues, and he explains what exactly this mistake was that was made.
Yeah.
Quote, this is what I said. The present is a distraction. The future, a dream. Only memory can unlock the meaning of life. End quote.
Yeah. And it's funny because you did quite a bit of research here.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. So I was like, oh, Leto said that. Leto said that like 2000 years ago or something like that.
Yeah.
But that's not the case, is it?
Not the case. Not the case. Because the quote we just read earlier, he says, Moneo, I once made a mistake tens of thousands of years ago when I was another person.
Oh, you know what? Reading comprehension. My bad. Oops.
So obviously Leto didn't exist 10,000 years ago and was never another person, but he was like, quote unquote, that person in his other memory. You know, he's kind of playing with words here. Again, to Malky's point, he's sort of embodying this other memory of this other person who said it 10,000 years ago. And I was like, okay, who said it then? You know, is this a real quote?
Yeah.
I went down many rabbit holes on Google and I was like looking up old texts. And what I found was that this quote is attributed to a Sir Desmond McCarthy, a real person, who was a critic in the early 20th century. This quote seems to come from one of his published reviews of the biography of Thomas Hardy, which was written by Thomas Hardy's wife after his death. So like a book review. He was just reviewing a book. This guy's just like a critic. And it's tough to figure out if Frank is actually like making an intentional connection here of some sorts to Sir Desmond McCarthy or Thomas Hardy. I don't know enough about these two people to know if Frank is making some deeper commentary. My theory is that this is perhaps Leto just sort of commenting on the fact that the words of a critic of a book had such an impact because they were said so beautifully, right? We all know how Leto feels about biographies, right? And how words can't capture the true essence of a human life, right? It always oversimplifies it down and tries to find narratives that may or may not have existed.
Right, right.
And perhaps Leto has the other memories of both Sir Desmond, the critic who read the biography, but also literally the man Thomas Hardy himself. So hilariously, Leto can probably just fact check whether Hardy's biography actually captured Hardy's life, because he can experience both of those things, what the critic said after his death and the actual life that was lived by Thomas Hardy. That's me perhaps reading too much into it. That's just my theory. I cannot say for certain what Frank's intention was with this quote pulled from a review of a book by a critic. But that's what my research came up with.
I mean, it's super interesting. And it's true. I mean, this was published in a newspaper, looks like in 1928.
Correct.
So like the idea of Frank having that idea and that belief of biographies and writers and authors and what does history show, I could see all that coming into place. And yeah, that's speculation on our part. But at the same time, it lines up regarding timeline, right? And it lines up with something that seems within the realm of what Frank would have encountered just as someone naturally as an author and as a person engaged in literature and having other author friends and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, that's interesting. That's a great find. Good job.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I'm like looking at old scanned pages of a 1928 like literary journal that had a bunch of book reviews in it and stuff. I was like, I can't believe this is where I've ended up. Like, what the fuck is happening here?
This episode was a lot because for the morsels, I ended up looking at scans of like books on the history of traditional no plays in Japan literally just reading full pages of the script of no play. It's fantastic.
So, wow. I mean, for a second, I was like, do I track down Thomas Hardy's biography written by his wife and read it so I can know what frame? And then I was like, no.
It's a bullet point.
First, I simply don't have the time. But also, like, who knows if Frank even meant it to be that deep. Maybe it is just like the words of a critic couldn't capture the actual life of the person. And that's an idea that I think Leto would really vibe with.
Yeah, it's also true that like regardless of where Frank kind of pulled it from and regardless of maybe where that kind of initial reference draws the attention, it is also the case that Leto brings the point home, right? And he kind of explains what he means in this context. And in this context, that quote from him is saying, quote, "My words were a foolish lie," Leto said. "I knew it at the time, but I was infatuated with the..." Why am I reading it like this? "My words were a foolish lie. I knew it at the time, but I was infatuated with the beautiful words. No, memory unlocks no meanings. Without anguish of the spirit, which is a wordless experience, there are no meanings anywhere." And
beautiful. Love it. Your Leto voice.
Thank you. And so, of course, this ties in very directly to discussions we've had about words, about meaning, about truth and subjectivity and objectivity, and the inability of words, mere words, to capture the true essence of the human experience. And I know Alan Watts is doing a little dance in his grave. But another layer here is that Leto is the first and foremost expert on memory. I mean, if anyone's going to talk about memory, it's going to be Leto or Bene Gesserit. But again, Leto's got the full picture.
Right.
And memory's effect on meaning. So his opinion here, at least within the context of Dune, carries about as much weight as it could.
Yeah, certainly. He's got all the memory that ever existed in human history. Yeah. And for him to say that that's not what brings meaning, that's not where you can find purpose, is the past. That's not where you can find a reason to exist or a reason to do things. That's powerful for him to say. There's other things that are more important.
When it comes to all of his memories and all of the time that Leto has spent and all of the time accessible to him, thousands of years of life, literally.
Yeah.
But then also effectively infinite memories going back as far as memories can go have shown him where meaning comes from. And it's the anguish of the spirit, right? The conflict that your spirit comes into. Yeah. And that sounds an awful lot like Amtal.
Don't say it, they said it.
Amtal. Again, I think it's kind of one of the themes. I think it's one of the themes of the whole book.
Yeah.
It's that like combat that your spirit gets into.
Yeah. I don't think this is like an outlandish or foreign idea, right? The idea that overcoming challenges is part of what gives life purpose and meaning. Yeah. I think that's even today like a very modern idea that a lot of folks perhaps take to an extreme, but certainly that's an idea that exists, that having a cozy, easy life where you always take the easy path isn't necessarily going to give you purpose or satisfaction. And sometimes overcoming the challenge is part of what makes life meaningful.
Yeah, I also think that when he talks about like anguish of the spirit, which is specifically a wordless experience, the idea of wordless experiences, not that there are individual experiences that are wordless, but that every experience is wordless until you then articulate or try to talk about it, gets to something that I always, in my little soapbox that I've ended up on a few times, which is this idea of like, why is art and music?
Why is art? I was just about to bring that up.
Yeah, it's like, why do these things matter? And why do they resonate with us? Why is it so impactful for so long? And I think it goes to, you know, you feel sad, but your sadness is this complex, infinite experience in your body. The experience itself is very complex and nuanced. And you say, knowing you're simplifying it, I feel sad. Someone else goes, I also feel sad. And you don't feel true camaraderie in that moment because there is a sort of expectation, well, I simplified it so much, it's not even really that accurate to say I'm sad.
Right, right.
So there's no chance that we feel the same sadness. But then you see a sad painting by a sad painter that captures so perfectly a feeling that you've had in your life. And you go, holy shit, I know for a moment that I'm not alone in this universe. It's the wordless experience.
It's the wordless.
And finding those moments of wordless experiences to bring those to the foreground.
Or you hear a poem about a wilting leaf floating in an autumn wind.
Yeah.
And you're like, damn, do I identify with that wilting leaf floating in an autumn wind?
You know, maybe you do. Maybe you do.
So that's our second takeaway. Some interesting ideas about words, their power, their lack thereof, and how beautiful words can still be hollow.
Yeah.
And Leto sort of recognizing that here in this quote from Sir Desmond McCarthy.
He's like, words are meaningless. Anyway, back to writing my 1,000 journals.
Right. Meanwhile, he's like scribbling so many journals every night, weeping into his notebook.
Anyway, dear diary, I miss we.
True. I miss her so much, the words could never capture this. Yeah. All right. Well, those are our takeaways from today's reading. A lot to pick apart in the conversation between Malky and Leto.
Indeed.
And Moneo.
Yeah.
But let's take one final break, because up next, folks, we have some spice morsels. They're finishing up in the oven. They need one more minute.
Ooh.
So we will see you.
Yes.
In one more minute.
Welcome back, everybody. Oh, I hope you enjoyed your break. Let's start off our morsels with one that is bird flavored, a bird morsel, the
yes.
Nightingale. So in our reading, Leto thinks back to an ancient verse and recites it for Moneo.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, the nightingale nests in the plum tree, but what will she do with the wind? The answer is simple. Let the nightingale keep to her flowers. End quote.
Huh.
Now, as always, we're like, hey, that's an ancient verse, you say. I bet that's something Frank found. Let's find
right.
it, too.
Yep.
And searching around the web, we were actually surprised to find the origins of this little quip. So we wanted to share it with you here. Now, in the book that I ended up reading some portion of, the No Theater of Japan, No is N-O-H, N-O-H, No, Theater of Japan, with complete texts of 15 classic plays by Ernest Fenollosa and Ezra Pound, we get the classic No play, Genjo. And Leto's quote is from part one of Genjo, and this is a larger excerpt. Quote, and the old man, not knowing, went on playing the biwa and singing Etenraku, the upper cloud music. This song, the nightingale nests in the plum tree, but what will she do with the wind? Let the nightingale keep to her flowers. End quote. Now, I had to look up Etenraku.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Is a form of Japanese classical music. It's like a classical form of
gotcha.
Storytelling and music. And it actually was introduced initially by Chinese Buddhists to Japan, but was very much then embraced by Japanese culture and became very much a part of Japanese culture. This was also in the 6th century, so pretty early in Japanese culture.
Right.
And then also the biwa lute, right?
Yeah, the biwa lute was referenced. That stood out to me from this quote that you pulled from the Genjo play, but we talked about in a previous spice morsel, maybe an episode or two ago, about the biwa lute and how Moneo's assistant outside his office was playing her lute in that way, and he was listening to the beautiful music. So it's fun to see that clearly at some point in his life, Frank had a real, like, I'm into Japanese culture and history phase, and we yeah. see some of that here in the book.
Yeah, it's true. I don't really remember. I know quite a bit about Japanese culture from being there for a bit and studying art history, and Japanese yeah. art history was one of the classes I took, and it's funny because, like, I don't remember that many references to Japanese stuff in the first few books. And this suddenly this book has a bunch. So
right,
I'm definitely
right.
picturing like 1979. Frank was like, holy fucking shit, that island's cool. You know?
Right. Man, give him a couple more years of life and he would have really gotten into anime. You know? He was on the cusp of anime coming to America because that happened like late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah. The final book actually was going to involve like Pokemon
Goku.
And Goku and Card Capture Sakura and Robotech. It was
right,
going to be so
right.
sick.
Damn.
Be so awesome.
Damn. Yeah. Siona going Super Saiyan.
Godzilla is referenced. Well, bringing this classic Japanese rabbit hole back to God Emperor of Dune. This is a play. Very cool. Nice to see it from Genju, the no play. this reference that Leto is making to an ancient verse from a No play brought to mind some similarities between No Theater, N-O-H Theater, and maybe some of God Emperor of Dune's themes.
Yeah.
And specifically, the stories, No plays, are often a spirit or a deity taking the form of a hero character. They attempt to accomplish some task, and then they're foiled by another dominant character. And it's usually a pretty small cast. But in narrating their tale, they're often the actual narrator of the tale. Like, I am going to do this thing, and this is how things are going, and this is how stuff is happening.
Right.
Which very much, to me, almost feels like, you know, it'd be hard to find the foil, like the individual foil character. But you could almost say that God Emperor of Dune fits that form pretty well. Of Leto having this kind of supernatural ability of prescience and then taking the form of narrator telling us everything that's happening.
Right.
Is very cool. And that has a nice parallel between No Theater and God Emperor of Dune.
Yeah, definitely. I like that parallel you've made between the plays. I also want to point out that there's sort of like a real direct connection in this moment too, because this quote about the nightingale happens as Leto is talking to Moneo about how his time as God Emperor is going to make for real good theater someday. He says, quote, "You and I, Moneo, whatever else we do, we provide good theater," end quote.
That's
and then he goes on a mini TED talk about like, religion makes for good theater, my religion, You and I are going to end up being some real good theater for people, blah, blah, blah. So clearly it all ties into this theater idea, Japanese culture, history of where that quote comes from.
Yeah, and Leto has also made it clear that he's very cognizant of how his actions and his empire are going to be the stuff of legend one day.
Yeah.
Misrepresented and represented accurately and all this stuff. So acknowledging a quote from a play from 40,000 years ago and saying, here's this little quote from a play. You know what? This is probably similar to a form of what people will talk about us in, you know, 30,000 years or whatever. Very, very, very cool. And again, fucking wild. I found this in a classic No play in a book via Google Books.
Yep.
I'm trying to picture Frank in the 70s and 80s finding this shit.
Right.
Like how dude? How do you, well, what Leo, section of the fucking library do you go to for all this?
I was
going to
say, having fun isn't hard when you've got a library card.
Okay. Yeah. But, you know, I've been to plenty of libraries. I haven't been to all the sections, and it really feels like Frank has been to quite a few of the sections.
Yeah. I admire the broad scope of his interests, right?
Yeah.
He seemed like a man who wanted to learn and loved to learn a lot of things and absorbed a lot of things.
I was thinking maybe because we know that he was like casual friends with Alan Watts, and Alan Watts was a Buddhist. So like maybe through that Buddhism and Chinese Buddhism and maybe conversations they had, he was like, oh shit, that's cool. But like, that's starting to feel like I'm tying red string from little facts that we know about the man. So,
okay, Charlie Day.
I know. There's no, there's no Frank Herbert this whole time.
This whole time. It's been Shakespeare this whole time.
Shakespeare, not again.
All right, let's talk about Spice Morsel number two today, Kanawa. So from today's reading, Duncan is in Tono Village struggling with his thoughts about beautiful, beautiful Hui Nori how she's going to marry that old goddamn wrinkly-ass worm.
Ew, so
bastard.
Wrinkly. Bastard. Oh,
so wrinkly.
Worm.
And specifically, he talks about this feeling of jealousy. And we get this quote. Quote, "The Fremen word for that intense emotion, Kanawa, the iron ring of jealousy," end quote.
Hell yeah.
And as always, we jumped into action. And by that, I mean, I pulled out my keyboard. I typed in google.com. And we did some research here. And we looked into the history of that word. And it is another reference to Japanese culture and history. So getting into it, when you take the kanji for the word iron, which is tetsu in Japanese, when that comes together with the kanji for the word ring, wa, in Japanese, it can be read as kanawa.
Yeah.
For example, kanawa mushiu, steam sauna in Japan.
Yeah. I'll point out here, first of all, if you watch My Hero Academia, there is a guy whose power is he turns to metal, or he is made of metal. You know that guy? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
His name is Tetsu Tetsu. which is just iron, iron.
Iron, iron, right.
Which is kind of fun.
That's fun.
But then the other thing is, when I looked up these two kanji together, I saw it pronounced as sometimes tetsuden. And tetsuden just seems to be another reading or another pronunciation of those two kanji together, the tetsu and wa together. But according to nihongodera.com, it seems to be an alternative reading. Now, I took 3 years of Japanese. I don't understand how alternative readings work. Like, if it's just like a dialectical thing, I don't know if you say it differently if you're in Okinawa or if you're in, like, I don't know. But yes. And even on Google, I hated this, because if you put the two kanji together on Google, like Japanese to English, it'll say in English words, kanawa, underneath the two together. But then you hit, I want to hear it, and it goes, tetsuden. And
no,
it's like,
way.
Fuck off, which one is it? And then everywhere I was looking, I was seeing tetsuden, tetsuden. And I was like, is it kanawa or isn't it? It is.
Interesting.
But it seems to be an alternative reading, and maybe one that's not used as much, maybe, because tetsuden includes the word tetsu, so it's less transformative, it's less memorized. I don't know.
Maybe some native speakers in our audience can help us out with that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, to continue with our morsel here, there's actually, circling all the way back to the no plays we just talked about, there's actually a Japanese no play called Kanawa. And the website, theno.com, has a summary of this play. And we want to read you an excerpt from it, because it really does seem to align with some of these Fremen ideas that Duncan is wrestling with. The no play Kanawa, quote, expresses the horror of the resentment and jealousy of women through the evil figure of a demon, end quote.
Mm.
And then later on the website, in the summary, it also says, quote, the grudge of an abandoned woman is strong enough to overwhelm the existence of the powerful diviner, end quote.
Yeah, I thought that was wild. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, there's that idea of jealousy, resentment. In the no play, a woman scorned, but here a Duncan scorned in our story. And you could easily draw a line between the idea of a powerful diviner and, oh, I don't know, a god emperor, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah. In the summary and like the synopsis of the play, which I, to be totally honest, I didn't read super carefully, but does include a character who has abilities, has like supernatural abilities.
Oh,
and although the takeaway of the play is that this jealous being was defeated, the implication is that the jealous being could come back because it wasn't defeated for good. All of that being said, the impermanence of defeat, also the power of jealousy, even over these like supernatural abilities. And I'm like, shit, so much of this lines up. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, that's interesting. Again, much like some of the research we've done throughout this episode, it's not super clear that like this is exactly what Frank is referencing.
Right, right.
Whether or not this actual play named Kanawa is what Frank is pulling inspiration from, or he simply is taking the word, we can't say for certain, but it is very interesting to see what our research dug up here when we looked into it.
Yeah. And I definitely thought initially, because we went from like no Japanese references in multiple books to a bunch in like three pages.
Yeah.
Part of me thinks he found a book on no plays and Japanese theater and read it and was like, oh, this shit's super cool. I should mention this in the next book I write.
Totally. Totally.
Well, in any case, we have one final bonus morsel.
Because
we love you. And that is Leto's Cart Part 5 or Part 12 or whatever part, because we've talked about it a few times. And specifically, this is an amendment, a fix, a much sought after balm to a burn that the Dune Encyclopedia caused.
So true.
In our fifth spice morsel episode, we shared from the Dune Encyclopedia the royal cart entry that suggested, much to our profound existential dismay, that Leto drives his cart and controls it with his gross little flipper feet, his little atrophied flipper legs. And we, with no real evidence, were like, we're going to disregard that and not believe it ever again.
Right.
Done. We're moving forward with our lives. Now, luckily, we had no evidence before. We have evidence now. Today's reading puts that terrible possibility to rest. It is the nail in the coffin. Quote, when they left, Leto closed the cart's bubble cover and saw moonlight reflected from it. At his beckoning thought, the cart and its burden returned to the landing lip. End quote.
There you go.
Beckoning thought. He controls it with his mind.
Controls it with his mind.
Mind bullets.
No flippers in sight.
That's telekinesis, Kyle, for Tenacious D fans. No flipper joysticks. Dual shock, get out of here. It is mind control.
That's right.
Thank God.
Thank goodness. I mean, the Dune Encyclopedia rarely misses, but it missed on this one.
Oh, thank God.
And we can confirm that in prime canon, in Frank's own words, Leto controlled the cart with his mind.
Yep. And I will be obnoxious about this. If anyone tries to bring up the fucking encyclopedia entry, I'm going to be like, no, actually, you're wrong.
Actually, on page 340.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, on this tattoo I have on my arm,
it's just
here's the quote.
The full quote. Yeah. Beckoning thought. They're like, what's that? Is that like an aspiration? No, oh, it's proof. Because I don't like flipper legs controlling cars.
Yeah.
And they back away so slowly. So true.
All right. Those are our morsels today, folks. And that is our episode.
Mm.
What a fun one. We got to do some real deep dive research in this one. And as we near the end of the book, we have some homework for you folks.
Indeed we do.
We only get to say this a couple more times for God Emperor of Dune. But for the next episode, make sure you've read chapters 47 and 48. And if you have a different copy than us, just read to the end of the chapter about rock climbing.
Yeah, that'll make sense.
It'll memorable. Really make sense. Trust us. Yeah. It'll make sense. And we are avoiding, normally we provide a final sentence, but we're avoiding a quote because it is a massive, perhaps the biggest spoiler of the book.
Yeah.
And we're going to save it for the next episode to talk about. So just read until the rock climbing chapter. You will know which one. Trust us.
God bless. This book is so good. All right, before we let you go, dear listeners, we want to remind you of some ways to support the show and keep in touch with us. And listen, two best ways, as always, as it has always been.
Tell me.
First, become a patron over at patreon.com/GamjaBar. Get yourself some Dune-themed swag. Hello. Merchandise. What? GamjaBarShop.com.
Wow.
Those links are in the show notes. And I'll also point out, as we launch into 2024, there's going to be more and cooler content on the Patreon page.
That's right.
So if you haven't, it's going to be very cool. It's a big goal for us and it's going to be awesome. So if that sounds good to you, if that sounds interesting to you and you like what we do and you're in a financial place to do so, support us on patreon.com.
That's right. And one last reminder before we say goodbye, we love to hear from you.
Yes.
So email us, gamjabarpodcast@gmail.com. Send us your thoughts as you read along with us in the book. Send us your questions. And of course, people are starting to think this is mandatory, but it really isn't. But I like the idea that it could be. Send us cute pictures of your pets.
Yeah, indeed.
We got an email the other day where the subject line just said, !! Cat picture inside, !! Mm. And boy, did I click on that. It could have been junk email. It could have been a virus, but I clicked on that bad boy.
Yeah.
So email us.
Was it a virus? Was it a cat picture?
It was a very cute cat picture from a listener. So email us, gamjabarpodcast@gmail.com. We love to hear from you, and we try to respond to every single one.
You know, I just opened it up. We got an email from Hunter Fritz, who sent us some acrylic Dune paintings, which is very, very cool. Oil paintings. Whoa, cool.
Incredible.
And, hey, Hunter seems to be from Missouri, so I suspect he has a very similar accent
to Malky.
To Malky, yeah. Well, friends, there is no real ending. It's just the place where you stop the recording. But this podcast is always one step beyond logic. So help spread the word of Muad'Dib and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And be sure to check out the other shows on the Lore Party Podcast Network on loreparty.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram @lore_party. We're also on TikTok @GamjaBarPodcast. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, whoever controls the podcast controls the universe. We'll see you on the golden path.